Welcome to the Gay Buddhist Forum, where teachers from all schools of Buddhism offer their perspectives on the Dharma and its application in modern times, especially for LGBTQI audiences. These talks are offered freely to the world and made possible by appreciative listeners. If you would like to support our efforts to share the Dharma with underserved audiences, please visit gaybuddhist.org. There you can donate, find a list of upcoming speakers, or enjoy many hundreds of these recorded talks dating back to 1996.
Okay, and it's time to go around and say our names. If you're here for the first or second time, would you also indicate that when you say your name, please? My name is Douglas.
Joe.
Howard.
I'm Carl.
John.
George.
Name is Jay.
Baruch.
Peter.
Rich.
Scott.
Daniel.
Charlie.
Bill.
Peter.
Tony.
Bob.
And John.
Jack.
Peter.
Marty.
Richard.
I'm Ray Dyer.
Jim.
Paige.
Doug.
Esmeralda.
Bob.
I'm Tom.
Dave.
Herbie.
They are.
Richard,
Jerry,
Steve,
Lee,
Buck,
Michael,
Tatron,
second time,
Peter Wong,
Jason,
Molly,
I'm Ed,
Michael,
Tom,
Paul,
Marvin.
Okay, our speaker today is the Venerable Amy Miller. She grew up in Philadelphia, but she came to Tibetan Buddhism and to California in about 1987. And she organized a Tibetan Buddhist group in the city in 1990 and began teaching in 1992 and ordained as a Buddhist nun in 2000. She has great administrative skills, and she was director of Our Home Away From Home, the Vajrapani Institute, in its canyon, Redwood Canyon in Santa Cruz from 1995 until 2004. And she has also organized pilgrimages to Tibet with various organizations, and she has assisted the travels of Tibetan speakers internationally. And she also is a woman of discipline, and she has completed a 7-month solitary retreat at Vajrapani. Amy?
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. I'm delighted to see all of you, and I was a little confused about our location today, and last year I taught on Hartford Street. Some of you are familiar? And I was here once before, several years ago. So it's wonderful to see this space, and it's a beautiful space to sit in. So I'm happy to see some of you again that I recognize, and some of you that have been to Vajrapani. So I thought I would talk a little bit today about retreat, because some of you are headed to Vajrapani to do retreat. And certainly if you have questions and things like that. So I'm excited that you are interested in doing retreat. It's one of my favorite things to do. And I would say there are a lot of ideas we have about retreat. And a lot of those ideas seem to fit a structure that we feel it has to look a certain way and be a certain way. But what I've come to know after, most of the retreats I do are 3 to 4 month retreats. And a place that has worked really well for me is a place very high in the mountains in Nepal, near Mount Everest. But I've also done retreats at Vajrapani Institute. So what I've learned from those periods is retreat is actually what I'm going to make of it. And also, please interrupt me if you can't hear me or you don't understand a word that something I'm saying. So it used to be that a lot of Westerners feel that, or people that live in our countries, feel that retreat has to be silent, and I have to get up at 3 a.m, and I can't eat any meat, and there's certain rules, and there becomes a rigidity to that. So what I found is that a structure is really important. However, we're trying to get to having a flexible mind. So that means that there has to be some flexibility. And so initially I started in a lot of silence, and I set my schedule and and every session was about the same, and I wouldn't deviate from that. But as I a little bit matured in my retreats, and I'm still pretty much a beginner in many ways, I learned that every day is different and every day is the same. You know what I mean by that? That every day there's a structure, and yet my mind, I wake up and my mind could be totally different that day. So there's times now where I adjust, I have the same maybe time for the sessions, but sometimes in the sessions I alternate what I do in the sessions. And sometimes I wake up and I'm prepared to do a very concentrated meditation, but I can see after 15 or 20 minutes that my mind is not cooperating. So it's better for me to back off and say, this isn't working right now. And I'm pushing. And it's better that right now I read this prayer and just sit quietly with that and enjoy that I'm alive and I'm feeling okay today. And then sometimes I find in an afternoon session, when I didn't plan to do a certain meditation, I try it and suddenly there's a really nice space. So I would just encourage you to check out the flexibility and see, especially I'm talking more about solitary retreats, but even in group retreats, we've adjusted schedules because we found out that this isn't really working for people. And I know that my understanding is your group, and sometimes I tell a funny story. Some of you remember this. When the first GBF group was booked at Vajrapani, it was the year before I was the director, and a close friend of mine was the director. And I think I'm thinking maybe Daishin Davidson Seri called and phoned. I don't know if some of you know him or remember. Anyway, this man called to our center to book, and he was worried about that it was a gay retreat. He didn't know how that would be received. So he calls the woman at the time, who's living with her girlfriend at the center. And he says, well, we're interested in booking a weekend for our group. And she says, great. And our group is men. It's all men, he starts out with. And then she says, okay, great. And he says, well, we're men from San Francisco. We're all men. And she says, okay, great. And then he keeps trying to let her know without specifically saying that we're gay men. So it's so funny. So she, you know, had great gaydar, and she immediately was like, but it's a gay group. So he keeps saying, well, and finally he just blurts out that he doesn't know what to say. And he says, well, we're a gay men's group. And then she's like, oh, great, I live here with my girlfriend, and it's he just had this huge sigh of relief. So it's been wonderful, because ever since then, every September that I could remember, the groups come down, and it's gone through various fluctuations, as a lot of groups do, which is understandable. So it's really been wonderful to meet the different people that have come down. And what on a more traditional level, and I'll also talk more about our individual, what we want in retreat, but just refresh me how long the talk?
We like to stop at 11:50 for announcements.
Okay.
So if you want questions before that.
Okay, great. So there's another thing traditionally in, let's say, the Tibetan system of how we like to do retreat, but this also permeates other traditions and other spiritualities. A lot of this is common sense. So the things you want to look at in retreat are, you need a conducive place to do practice. And also, some people here are probably not ready to do retreat, and they're not that interested, but I would encourage you at some time to make a space in your life. It could be that you have a Saturday in your own home and you live in a relatively quiet place, and you might just take an afternoon to sit quietly. Retreat is about getting to know your mind. That's really, it's not a big magical mystery tour. It's about getting to know your mind. And I don't mean to sound cliche that it's getting to know yourself and becoming your own best friend, but it is about getting to know yourself better. And a lot of those passages for me have been about accepting myself, and that means all the mistakes that I make and all the little pockets of myself I'm not comfortable with. It also is a place for me to forgive myself for stuff that I've done that I haven't been happy with. And then also rejoicing in all the good that I have in me and all the good that I'm able to do for people. So these are places, those three exercises for me, acceptance, forgiveness, and rejoicing, are a major part of retreat for me. And it actually is, it doesn't leave my everyday life now, because you can keep that retreative mind with you all the time. So I really find it difficult more and more as people say, I have an altar set up and I have a sitting place, or when I come to Bartlett Street, that's Dharma practice. That's my spiritual practice. And when I'm pushing my cart in Safeway or Whole Foods, I'm not practicing there. You know, then I think we've missed it. So for me, it's got to be everywhere. You know, that when you're checking out in Safeway, we have a little Bodhisattva warrior practice when you're at Safeway. How do you practice in the grocery store? I go to the grocery store as a Bodhisattva warrior. I'm not a Bodhisattva yet, but I practice. It's all about practicing the attitude. And that's what retreat gives you time, more time to do. So like a Bodhisattva warrior goes to the supermarket, I do my shopping, I have my cart, get my shopping. And the other thing you can do when you're shopping is, I'm looking, I'm a little bit noticing who's in the aisle with me, because sometimes people need help. You know, the other day I'm in the aisle, there's a man with his young son, and he's stuck in front of the pickles. There's a whole pickle. I mean, this is back in Philadelphia where my parents live, and I see the man really stressed. I see the kid in the cart a little bit stressed, and he's studying, you know, the pickles, and then I come down the aisle, and then he turns to me and he says, "Please, do you know where the pickled beets are?" You know, and I could see that probably his wife had sent him to the store, and he's clueless, like where the pickled beets are, okay? So then I look, and I see that he's just looking at all the pickles, and I said, I think it's canned vegetables. I said, I'm thinking beets are going to be in canned vegetables. Okay, so it's in the same aisle, and we both turn around, canned vegetables, and I said, oh, and there's the beets. And he's so excited, you know, and he, thank you. And then he says to me, my wife thanks you. So there's a lot of people in the store. This is where you get to practice. There's a lot of people in the store that need help. But what I do is I finish the shopping. And then the normal thing you do is you look for the shortest line to check out, right? The cities are busy places, okay? So I check out. So what you do is the guy in front of you is not done yet. You can't unload. So I'm waiting. So what do you do when you're waiting? Be honest. What do people do when they're waiting? You read the tabloids, right? You read the tabloids, okay? Bodhisattva warriors don't always read the tabloids. So what we do is, what I practice doing is, I'm now in line. I can't unload yet. But what I'm doing is, I have a big cart full of stuff. So I'm just going to scan behind me, because there's somebody with one jar of mayonnaise looking for the shortest line. So I'm going to let them go in front of me. Because I love it when I just have eggs and somebody lets me go and I'm in a hurry and I don't feel like waiting behind the woman with all the diapers and the laundry detergent. And so these are kind of things that you practice this, you get used to what I'm supposed to do in retreat. And then when you go out and you're on Muni or you're riding your bicycle, or you're driving in your car, that retreat mind is there with you. It doesn't have to be separate. So we like to separate. We're doing that all the time. I have my spiritual practice, but this weekend I'm going to do retreat. So I prefer to have it all integrated. So some of the conditions on retreat is you'd like to have a conducive place to practice. That means a quiet place. It means a place that's free of distractions. It's also a safe place. That means there are no wild animals there. There are no dangerous people, no environmental toxins, or as little as possible. Things like this, because the mind needs to be rested and not concerned and worried. You know, the safer you feel, you know that feeling. I think for a gay man to live in the Castro, it's a wonderful feeling because you're free to be who you are. You don't have to hide who you are. So you want that feeling because the mind starts to, I would say, disengage from all the busy noise. And so another thing, when you're getting into retreat, and sometimes on the retreat at Vajrapani, I think it's just a weekend, it's relatively short. So what happens on retreat is a lot of times people get into retreat for a weekend or a week, and there's so much they have to do in their lives to get ready that by the time they get into retreat, they're exhausted, right? So one of the things you want to do is make space. I honestly say this before you go down there for the weekend, even if it's 1 or 2 hours, to rest yourself. If you need to take a nap, if you need to go to bed early the night before, whatever you need to do is plan the time so you're not running right up until you get into the car and drive down. The drive down there from here is perfect also, because it's, you know, you might take 280 or, and you slowly, you go through the trees and you start to unwind. Some people may choose to go down the coast like that, but it allows you time. But if there's time before that to have a little bit of a break, it's really, really helpful. I have gone into the 7-month retreat I did. I had 2 weeks at the beginning, and I had just finished being the director of the center and trained a new director and totally getting out of that position. So the first 2 weeks, I just allowed myself to rest without formal sessions. Because my body, I couldn't meditate until my nervous system was rested and disengaged. Because you find what happens is you get into retreat and you're like, okay, you know, I have 2 days and I have, and you're pushing, but there's no rest in here so that the meditation can come organically. Does that make sense? So I would encourage, I know with 2 days or 3 days, there isn't a lot of time, but just find sometimes you might, I like time on retreat to just space out. Meaning I'm just sitting in a chair looking out the window. I'm not reading. I'm not writing anything. I'm just, and it might be 5 or 10 minutes to just kind of look around at the trees. Vajrapani is a great place to do that. Just look at the birds and without anything. I'm not talking to anyone. I'm not walking anywhere. Some of you might rent the retreat cabins and they have little chairs on the deck and it's perfect. So I find that really helpful. That's not a waste of time. So, and retreats are different. You may have a retreat. I've done retreats with absolutely no other activity other than meditation, other than watching my mind and building mindfulness. Some people choose to also write on retreat. They might keep a journal. Some people may read on retreat. Books that are conducive for their practice, that can be helpful. Some people listen to music or CDs. Some people may watch DVDs of their practice. There's no rule that this isn't allowed or you can't do that, things like that. It really depends on how, and it also with a group, obviously you'd have a structure and people would want to stay within that structure. That's great. But sometimes on your own or in your own time, if you find it's not too distracting and you're not bothering anyone else, it's really what you feel might work for you to put you more in a conducive space. So again, on a traditional note, It's helpful to have supportive people to serve you. Vajrapani is great for that. They serve vegetarian food that is very healthy, well thought out, things like that. And it's nice. It's actually located at the fork of two creeks. And apparently for retreat centers, that's supposed to be the ideal location. I can't remember the specific reason, maybe some people know, of why having two water sources. But I've also found for myself, I don't like to be too close to rushing water because I find that sometimes too noisy for me. But some people love the ocean, to meditate by the ocean or a river. Some people find that really soothing. For me, sometimes it depends on the type of river and the type of water, like that, by waterfalls or things. So again, it's important for you as you develop to do retreats more, maybe on your own or with other groups, is I would experiment with different situations, different centers, and again, different places that you like. You know, I happen to find the mountains tends to be, a higher elevation tends to work better for me. I was just joking with a friend of mine recently. We went to Crestone, Colorado. I don't know if anyone's been there. It's a fantastic place in, I think, southwestern Colorado. And I was teaching out there, and this friend drove me down there. There are a number of spiritual centers there. And it looks a bit to me like the Lhasa Valley 20-some years ago. It's a big, sprawling, open space. It's beautiful. So I said to her, 8,200 feet is about the elevation. And I said to her, oh, this is my optimum meditation altitude. and she was laughing, you know. And she's like, I can't believe you know that. You know, so some people find high elevation is great. Some people find they want to go to the ocean. So and what I would say also is I have friends that have been spending years and years and years trying to find the perfect retreat space. And they're running around the globe, and nothing is perfect anymore in this world. It just isn't. So sometimes I've found like you just get as close as you can get to what works. And if you need earplugs, use earplugs. And the world is getting more and more populated, so the noise issue is becoming louder and louder. So you do the best you can do and find something that works and just sit down and do it. Because our lives, I look around at the ages of a lot of people in here, probably around my age, a little bit older, and we're running out of time. So we just have to kind of get started now and not waste the time. So that's one thing I would say in encouragement. Another thing, just before I take some questions, is look at your own mind in what you can simplify in your life. So I have been staying a little bit with my parents. They're old now, and they live outside Philadelphia on the East Coast. So I just cleaned out 50 30-gallon garbage bags from their house. It didn't even make a dent. I mean, so I lead a really simple life, but look at things in your life you might like to simplify. Because what often happens is we have this idea of ourselves, and part of us says, I want to meditate more, or I want to learn how to meditate. But I can't do that because I have this, 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 and this. So it depends on your priorities. If meditation is really important for you, is it possible to take this 3-hour block that you spend maybe surfing on the internet, or hanging out in a cafe with your friends, or going to this party, or whatever it is, watching videos, whatever your thing is, and take an hour of it and change it and move it over to this category, meditation. So it's possible to do that. You just have to be honest and look at your life and see, what am I satisfied with? And there's always these little parts of our lives we're not that satisfied. So that's what we practice at. That's what we work at. And so what of that can I change? And then maybe what of your actual physical surroundings is not working? And what can I simplify? So you might have that closet in your house that needs cleaning out, but it becomes a big burden. So you don't have to do the whole closet at once. You know, maybe every week, 1 hour to cleaning out the closet. You know, in a month, it's probably finished, or 2 months. So break down these things so that it doesn't become a huge hurdle. And then suddenly there's clean space. I personally like a clean space because my mind feels clear in it. If I have too much clutter and too much, oh, I have to get to that room and that desk is piled high and these drawers, my mind's always kind of going off in these little areas. So I have found that helpful is as I simplify, I find I have less desires. Okay, so that's an interesting one. And the other flip side of that, which is another retreat condition, is being satisfied with what you have. So that's a tricky one. So aren't we always trying to kind of, you know, a little bit, make it a little bit better? Especially our society. Unbelievable. It is just unbelievable how, you know, I see people all the time. You know, a friend of mine just got a new mobile phone last year. And now it's, you know, now they invented something new. So I see he's, you know, I just got this. It's okay. It works fine. But now I need that one because it does it a little faster. So look at those kind of things in your life. What can you be satisfied with? Because that lends to a restful mind in a retreat situation, I have found. So that means that when the food comes, if somebody's cooking for you, when the food comes, whatever it is, it's okay. You know, because we often have this thing, and we get very attached to food. Those of you that go to the Vajrapani, I just know the scene when groups would come. Because sometimes food is all you have to kind of control. On retreat, you know, it's me and my mind. So people start, you know, and immediately the first day, you know, there's not enough protein, and I want more squash, and I want this, and when are you going to have pasta? And I, you know, and I see people get into these things because it's the only thing left for them to kind of go out to. And so it's an interesting one to just watch that. I've watched my mind in retreat. The food would come, and there'd be like, oh, I don't like this. I don't like tomato sauce. You know, just and then I just laugh at myself. So humor is really helpful in retreat. It's helpful in life, I think. But that ability to not take myself so seriously, you know, and it's interesting because retreat, you see people, you know, I'm meditating now. You know, it's a very serious thing. And it's not, it doesn't have to be that serious. And I've also had some lamas, some of my teachers were in retreat. And I was surprised because I have this idea that it's very strict and you don't see anybody for that time you're in retreat. And one of them kept inviting me for dinner during his retreat. And I'd arrive at the room and the attendants would say, Rinpoche is in a session now. Okay, so I'd wait. And then he'd finish and then I'd go in and there he was. Hi. How are you? You know, so there's lots of different ways to have a relaxed mind. And I would just say to encourage you to enjoy, because I did a very serious purification retreat some years ago. It was a 3-month retreat, and it was in Nepal, and my teacher was there just before I started the retreat, and he has a little cave there. So I think a few days before I started, I went into the cave to meet with him, and as I was leaving the cave and kind of ducking my head to get out, all of a sudden he called out to me, enjoy. And I turned around, and this retreat isn't supposed to be very enjoyable, is what people told me. So I turned around and I said, excuse me? And he said, remember, the most important thing is to enjoy. And that was some of the most helpful advice I got. Because sometimes on retreat, we're pushing, grinding, you have your whip out, I'm not good enough, you had a lousy session, I have no concentration. And every time that voice came up, I had this little voice, another voice that said, enjoy. So it really helped me because I could kind of laugh at myself. And it actually became, it was a fantastic retreat. I had so much fun on this retreat and actually went through a lot of purification on it. And it's always taught me since then to relax and enjoy, to have that space that my mind is in. And then I find the meditation works a lot better. So does that make sense? Is that? As Lama Yeshu would say, are we communicating? But do you have some questions? Any questions? Yes.
Hi, Amy.
Hi.
When you say that on that retreat, retreat that you so enjoyed and had so much fun that you went through a lot of purification. Can you say a little bit about what that consisted of or what you mean?
Right. So the retreat I was doing was called Vajrasattva, and it's a Tibetan practice predominantly where I'm visualizing a deity and I'm reciting a 100-syllable mantra 100,000 times. It takes about 2 to 3 months. And so what happens for people on this retreat is it's a deep purification practice, and that means that you may suffer a lot on the retreat physically and mentally. When you're purifying, it tends to bring up negative karma, and it can come up in a variety of ways. So I've had friends that had migraine headaches on the retreat and lots of physical ailments, stomach problems, skin rashes, because stuff is coming out of you. That's the symbolism of it. But it actually physically does bring things out of you. But the thing is, I found that better to do it in that retreat setting than when I'm dying and I'm not really going to be that much in control of my mind, and then to have purification happening. I would rather do it where I set aside 3 months, when I'm healthy, when my mind's somewhat working, and then to do it like that. So I had every day for, the retreat took me actually 2 months to finish the mantras, but I continued on for a while after. And I had a horrible cough until I finished the last mantra. It was amazing. I finished the last mantra and the cough ended like that. So for me, it was just a sign that this was part of the purification. It was a really bad cough. And also some nights I didn't feel well, and I think I had a fever. And if you don't feel well on retreat sometimes, I just went to bed early. I just did a short session and then went to bed early. You have to take care of yourself on retreat. You need to get enough rest. And so every day, though, in the 2 months, it was very odd. I had little physical manifestations all over my body. I had an eye infection. Everything lasted 2 to 3 days, and then it would turn into something else. It was bizarre. I had an eye infection. I had my thumb got infected. My toe got infected. I had a backache. It was just like that. Things just crawled around my body. And so what happened is I got really happy because I knew I was purifying. But it wasn't insurmountable. It wasn't the kind of thing where I couldn't get out of bed. And so after like the eye infection, I thought, oh, it's getting better. And then the next day I wake up and my toe is all blown up. And I was like, oh, okay. Well, I hope it doesn't get worse, you know. And so it was really interesting like that. And sometimes at the end of those retreats, you will have signs, dreams that you have purified. You could be drinking milk. You could be skiing in white snow or see a temple with beautiful flowers and a beautifully adorned temple. You could be wearing beautiful clothes like that. And those are signs of purification. So I had a dream once right at the end of one of these retreats that I was in a shower in a bathhouse that was magnificent, marble with pearls on the ceiling and crystal. And I was showering in this beautifully white-tiled, pristine bathhouse. And then when I looked down at my body, it was me when I was 11, like prepubescent, like totally innocent body. You know, so it was really interesting. So I took that as a sign of that the retreat had worked well. So you get things like that sometimes. So even after short retreats, too. Yes?
Yes, when you say that you, this practice of chanting to a deity, can you tell us, is it a secret who the deity is?
No, Vajrasattva is the name of the deity. Vajrasattva is a Sanskrit term. Dorje Sempa is the Tibetan. Dorje represents a thunderbolt, or Vajra in Tibetan. So Dorje Sempa is, Dorje is the diamond heart indestructible means you need to get enlightened that represents basically bodhicitta. And Vajrasattva holds a Dorje, a Vajra in his right hand, and a bell in the left hand that represents wisdom, which is the view you want to have to get enlightened. So Vajrasattva is basically the being of the Dorje, the one who, through those indestructible means of purification, will help get you enlightened. So what I did is I didn't actually chant to Vajrasattva, but I would visualize Vajrasattva either on the crown of my head or as myself, because I had the initiation so I could do that. And then I would recite this mantra with various light coming through me that was washing out the negativities.
Do you have a sense of communing with this deity?
Mm-hmm. Very much so when I was doing it. But I also had at the same time completely distracted mind. So it's not like I'm any holy being that, you know, the mind is just in the pinball machine. And so I would try to build concentration, but at times I'd be totally off the object. And then I would just, my meditation would be bringing the mind back to the visualization with Vajrasattva. And sometimes I'd have a great feeling, and other times I'd be distracted. And that's basically how retreat goes for most of us. And that's okay. Now I'm okay with it. In the beginning, I used to get so down on myself that I can't meditate and I have no concentration. We all know that mind, right? And it's, that's just meditation. Meditation is bringing the mind back to presence. Like that. Yeah, Lee.
Not really a question. I just wanted to thank you for this. I wanted to say that I hope that you will write it. I envision the title as Practical Wisdom for the Developing Buddhist. Reminds me a little of Lama Zopa Rinpoche's from Vajrapani, Transforming Suffering into Happiness. More day-to-day.
It's so interesting that, you know, I'm getting these messages from the universe. I've been writing since, I wrote a lot in my 20s. And I started to write a few years ago, and I've got kind of the beginnings of various books, and people keep saying to me, you need to write this down. And so it's interesting that I keep hearing that. So maybe at some point I'll put something together, and that'd be nice, yeah. Because I was just living in India for a few years, so I was sending passages to people of my experiences there, and that's where people started to say, you need to publish this. And so it would be nice to include some practical, because my Buddhist practice is very practically oriented. And I just find that helpful for most of us, because most of us are working people, and you need to be able to practice when you're walking down the street and driving your car and in the supermarket and things. So thanks for saying that. Yes?
This may be a situation that faces everyone someday. What do you do when you get older? I have met with a couple of senior groups at retreat centers. We've been on a committee at a larger group, and frankly, we give it up. The logistics for older people are just too difficult. So the only solution that we came up with is not really a solution, but it's develop your practice to the point where you don't need anything or anyone, so that you can do it wherever you are. If it's in a senior community or whatever, you just don't need people. Now, that's heartbreaking in a way, but if your heart breaks, there it is. I just had this thought that there are lots of younger people who might want scholarships, and seniors could just sponsor scholarships or part scholarships or something for a minimal amount of this to help you get over the rocks if you can't see at night, to help you get to wherever the libido is. And minor things like that, just getting up and down the stairs at Vajrapani, which I love so much. There are numbers of chairs and rocks and everything. And by the way, I have your Buddha Chashka that you gave me decades ago. Right next to my oxygen bottle. But I think that many people are just afraid of thinking what's going to happen to them when they get old. My God, I'm not enlightened, and I won't be enlightened then. What can I do? Well, of course, there's a part of you that's always enlightened. That's one. Two, when you can get in touch with whatever, you can get out of a certain number of friends. But if anyone comes up with any idea about what seniors might be able to do in connection with retreat centers so that it's good for the retreat centers and helps them, I would certainly appreciate knowing about it, because if meditation gives you a longer life, then...
I mean, one thing that could happen is setting up your own home site so that you can make that, because that's most of the places that people may want to die, let's say, in the future. But to set that up like your own sanctuary, and because then you can take care of the things like steps and bathrooms and things like that. And one of the things I'm really interested in doing, because we're all aging, and I look a bit younger than I am, but I do feel at this point that gravity is just sucking me into the ground. It's incredible, you know. My sister and I were just comparing notes, and, you know, the body just, you know, it's like, whew. So I'm going to settle for a while in northern Vermont on the New Hampshire border to run a center called Milarepa Center. And there's only an old farmhouse there and an old barn, and our wish is to develop a retreat center there. There's 300 gorgeous acres. And the place really does not have any money or anything. So one of my plans on the list of all the things I have is that I want to make the buildings, everything designed for wheelchairs and anybody, senior, whatever, because I'd like to have some sort of facility for, there will be retreat cabins there where people will do certain meditations that have chronic illnesses. So those retreat cabins will need to be totally outfitted for people that are not mobile. And in addition, I'd like to have a facility or part of that be for older practitioners, monks, nuns, and practitioners for growing old like that. So that's one of the things I'm really interested in, and doing it in as self-sustaining way as possible, because Vermont's very interested in that. And I've met some groups there already that help you use local materials and resources. So it's starting to develop, because our organization, FPMT, is starting to look at that as well. But now I have a property. It's not mine. It's the organization's. But I just want to try. I don't know if Vermont will let us develop and what we'll do, but we're going to try. And that's one of my main focuses, is everything needs to be designed for that.
The Zen Center here is having a meeting next week with seniors on the same topic. So it's nice to see that it's developing your main focus.
Because there's a woman, a friend I have in Berkeley, who works specifically with those issues. So she's actually got a resource of the administrative level of what's available for seniors, you know, meaning funding and things like that, healthcare. And then she's also got all the resources of how, when you want to build something, what are all the specifications and the ramps and the size of the doors and the beds and the toilets and showers and everything. So that's, we've been in contact, and she's already, we've already done, because she works with some kind of senior, I can't remember, for years she's done this, some kind of senior agency that she's researched all these things. So I think it's really essential that we start putting those things together. So unfortunately, there isn't anything I can point to now and say, there it is. But hopefully, in a few years, we could get some of these buildings developed and things like that. So, yes.
Thank you for coming and addressing us, because I think you're recording of your talk will probably serve as a great introduction for anyone before they go on any retreat in the future. So, thank you. Question: You mentioned that you, when you were on your purification retreat, it's something you would rather do before you reach your death. And then you also alluded earlier to, you know, time is running out, we should do this now. And it makes me wonder what you feel are the benefits. Maybe that's not the right word. The benefit, the goal, or, you know, what is the outcome that the average person would be looking for in retreat? What's the purpose of going on retreat? Why is there this urgency that we should embrace it?
My feeling is, on a spiritual path, and this is hard for a lot of busy Westerners in here. I know we're not all Westerners. There's probably some Asians among you, and is I've found meditation is really key to that, to spiritual development. So meditation in some ways would require some sort of retreative atmosphere. What retreat really is retreat from your delusions. So what I mean by that is I need time to look at my mind to see how it works in certain settings. And when I go into work and I get angry with my boss, or get angry with a coworker, or somebody's irritating me, I don't have as much facility there or space to be able to look at, well, what happened? Why is that bothering me? So that's why we take ourselves away, and you can just do this in your home every day. People sit every morning, every night, or any time you have time to step back and look at my mind and have, so what happened? That I messed up today at work, And, oh, I see, let me replay the conversation. And then when I replay it, I realize, okay, then that person said that, that pushed that button for me, and what I did is then I reacted back and yelled at them. And so what happens is in retreat and meditation, I'm able to then look at and say, yes, I have anger. That delusion comes up a lot, or my delusion. We have many delusions, but you know which ones. Some of you know certain ones are yours more. Some people are very prideful. Some people are extremely attached and consumed with desire. So there's many different delusions. And then I start to see what is manipulating my mind. And so in retreat, I start to identify it. Tibetan Buddhism is not about repressing, you know, these delusions. I have to notice it. Oh, yes, this is what's going on. And now what are the techniques to counter it when it happens? So I practice that in retreat, understanding the negativity of the delusion. And then I practice it in retreat so that when I'm back out in front of the person, I have a little bit more facility to battle it. It may take the 80th time with that person until I get it right, but this is about practice. Meditation is about practice.
Well, and I, what you're describing, I think, is really helpful. In, you know, living a better life, you know, improving the way we relate to others and all that. What I'm wondering is there something you were alluding to that we must do before we die that retreat assists us in?
I was going to use a little profanity for a moment. I was just thinking you really have to get your shit together. And in many ways, and each of us, it's your own individual way you're going to do that. So I can't say that one way is the best way, but what I mean is I would highly encourage some form of meditation daily. And it's very hard to get that started. I know some of you have that started, and some people are dying to get that started. It's hard. And what it means is having to sit for a long time, and I mean years and years, with a really distracted mind. But that consistency of sitting every day quietly and setting a positive motivation in the morning for my day, and maybe looking at the end of the day, how did the day go, and dedicating any positive energy towards my being a good person and leading a good life and making some progress, and creating and maybe increasing those periods a little bit each day, because that space gives me spaciousness in this heart-mind experience. So the mind in Tibetan Buddhism is located at the heart. It's not the brain. I'm talking about a subtle energy system. And so I want to keep increasing this until it's completely open. Because when it's completely open, I'm able to equally engage with everyone with equal respect and regard and that spaciousness and kindness and things. If you don't have any walls in here and constrictions, then other people have nothing to tangle with you over. So even you see with hostility, when hostility meets His Holiness the Dalai Lama or some of my teachers, or that when there's space, there's nothing for them to hit against. So they just end up going right through. You know, people that, where there's conflict and hostility, they want to come up against something. So for me, my practice is really whatever, whoever is in front of me and whatever is in front of me at any moment, how open can I stay to what's happening? And I found that very helpful in meditation. However, there are a lot of different meditations you can learn. So I couldn't say what actually is best for you. It's nice to try different things. The Zen tradition or the Tibetan tradition, the Vipassana tradition, and see what you find really works best for you, and then continue to do that. But I find making that space in the mind, the more I meditate and have a moment with myself to set the motivation, then later in the day, if I have a conflict with somebody, I'm more able now to call up, wait a minute, I had a really positive motivation for the day that meant that was about me being as spacious with others as I could and trying to help them as much as I could. So am I going to yell at this person now? That wasn't my ideal today, but so I catch it a little bit more quickly now. But you have to also be willing to know you will make mistakes and fall flat on your face, and I just pick myself up and say, well, I blew that, And the next time I see that person, I determine that I will be more patient with them. And things like so that's a practice, because we know how to practice, right? Look at the things we practice at that we're really good at. Our technology, right? We're unbelievable with that. You know, I see people, they get a new computer. First of all, how much time did you spend researching what computer you would buy? Or mobile phone, or DVD, whatever system, or flat screen TV, or it's incredible, right? So what about your mind? What about our minds? Because I'm not taking the flat screen TV with me when I die. Can't, but I'm taking my mind with me. So that seems to be pretty important, but our society doesn't influence us that way. Like that. So we have to protect a little bit, protect your mind and be careful what influences are coming in and things like that.
So that's the answer. You take your mind with you in like a...
Oh yes.
Okay.
And all of its imprints. All those karmic imprints that you planted, all those seeds.
Well, that's a good note to end on. Thank you, Amy. And by some strange cosmic coincidence, our host today is also from Philadelphia.
We met in high school. There's some grapes out here, and some cookies, and hot water for tea. And be careful when you open the tea machine. If you don't know how to press the right button, you know, if the water is very hot, please wash your cups after you use them. And there's another bowl. We partly survive on Ghana, and the typical figure that we give is $5 to $8, but please feel free to whatever meets your own personal requirements. And there's a sheet out there you can sign up if this is your first time. I don't think anyone said their first time. Someone said their second time. But sign up if you want to get on the newsletter. And there are copies of the latest newsletter out there, too. And let's see. I think that's it, right?
A lunch.
A group meets for lunch. Sometimes just hang out around the front. And when people come out there and look hungry and look like they want to go together, they'll get together and go to one of the places. And that's my mentor down there. Right, he's going to make me do it again. So thank you for being here.
Are there any other announcements, Carl?
Yeah, well, I was also born and raised in Philadelphia.
Oh, my God.
That's not my announcement, though. speaking of retreat, the annual LGBT retreat is coming up next month at Spirit Rock. It's in the Vipassana tradition. It's a 5-night silent retreat that has its wonderful structure to it that you're able to break and do what you need to do. But it's taught by two of our gay meditation teachers, Arena Weissman and Larry Yang. And it is a beautifully conducive space for retreat practice. The Spirit Rock hills and land is incredible, and it will be beautiful in mid-October, October 17th to the 22nd, and it's 5 nights, and the food is tremendous, and the facilities where we stay are very, very comfortable and Spartan, but beautiful, and the meditation hall is incredible. And it's obviously the people and the teachings that are really what it's all about, and that's very special as well. So if anybody wants to deepen their practice in the safety of a lesbian and gay community that has been retreating together for, I think, more than a dozen years, this is an opportunity. It's a sliding scale for payment, and there are even some scholarships. And so spiritrock.org is the website. So many of us have been over the years and hope to see the water place. Thanks.
Michael.
My name is Michael, and I'm not from Philadelphia.
But not far.
But not far. The registration deadline for our own retreat at Vajrapani is tomorrow, and basically we're full. But if you are still interested, talk to me, and may be able to squeeze an hour or two more.
Yes.
Rainbow Symphony concert this coming Saturday night at San Francisco Conservatory of Music, 8 p.m.
Howard?
Yeah, my name is Howard, and I have been to Philadelphia. Passed through. And just to remind all of us that GBF is an all-volunteer sangha, and we're always welcoming and looking for members of the Sangha who are ready and willing and joyfully ready to serve in the life of the Sangha. And if that call for service is ringing in your heart and soul, talk to me and a number of others in the Sangha who will help direct your gift into service here in the Sangha.
I'm Jerry, I'm your speaker coordinator, and thank you, Amy, for coming. Mm-hmm. Appreciate it. And next week we're going to, and my roommate and my neighbor next door are both from Philadelphia. next week will be Joe Weston, who is a Tibetan student, and he lives here in the Bay Area, but he's been a corporate trainer in Holland, and he's going to kind of talk to us about our power, how Buddhists can still have power in their lives, and they can say no. But there's a way he will probably teach us how to say that.
Yeah.
Seems like San Francisco should be considered the city of brotherly love. This is a short-term volunteer request for the newsletter. It's procedural. And this is the easiest volunteer thing at all, ever, I think. Every other month we send out the newsletter, and 3 weeks from today, September 28th, I'm going to be gone on vacation. I just organized the mailing. And this is a volunteer opportunity of 2 hours. No more commitment than that. So if anybody could fill in for me, please tag me afterwards. Thanks.
Yes, a reminder that our talks are available on the internet at the GBF website, gaybuddhist.org.
Okay, we'll have our closing circle. Could you do a dedication of merit for us?
May all of this positive energy that I feel in this room right now, may we invest it in all of our present and future goodness, wisdom, compassion, loving kindness, to help us flow to a place of full awakening. Because from that place, as Buddhas, we will have an unlimited capacity to be a benefit to all other living beings. May all beings be happy. May all beings be healthy. May all beings be free from suffering. May loving kindness manifest throughout our lives. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to the Gay Buddhist Forum. If you would like to hear several new talks per month and be notified of upcoming speakers so you can participate live, please subscribe to this podcast, like us on Facebook, and join our mailing list by visiting gaybuddhist.org.